Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. This is Tal Paul on the Ask Tal Paul Blog Talk Radio Show. Today we have our very special guest, the famous, the wonderful giant of permaculture, the Duke himself, Paul Wheaton. Welcome, Paul. How are you today?
I am awesome, Paul. How are you?
I'm sorry to have not called you Your Grace. So, Your Grace, I'm sorry. Here you are. You're back with us. Yay.
I think I could get used to this Your Grace stuff, but it does seem a little too formal, perhaps.
Okay. Well, today we have a very exciting discussion of a technique that many people might not know of, and it's called WOFATI, W-O-F-A-T-I, and it's an eco-building technique. And if you go to richsoil.com/WOFATI, W-O-F-A-T-I, that's Paul Wheaton's, one of his websites, and there's a whole description with drawings and kind of the evolution of how it developed. And I highly recommend you go to that website as we're speaking, so that way you can see the drawings and hear what Paul's talking about. And there's also a link in this episode to that article, and that will probably help you. All right, so Paul, tell us about WOFATI. And so at the top of the page it says, imagine living in something that looks like a log cabin from the inside, but it has more light. It doesn't need heat or air conditioning. It's 3 times faster to build, and it costs about 5 times less.
So this all kind of started a little bit. Years ago, I was looking at an opportunity to move onto some land, and it's kind of like, okay, I will arrive on the land in June, and I need to build something that will weather the Montana winter and before the snow flies. So I started looking into things that could build quickly and cheaply. And, of course, a lot of eco-buildings, usually they're either really slow or they're really expensive. So, like, straw bale stuff tends to be about 20 to 30 times more expensive than a conventional home. And cob stuff tends to take a really long time to build. And I kind of thought, well, you know what I've had great success with is pole buildings. And I started exploring this, and a lot of the books I started pawing through kept referring to the $50 and up underground house book. And I always avoided that book because it had the word underground right on the cover, and I knew I didn't want to live on an underground home. But I looked it up, and I realized I can do this design as an above-ground thing with a thick earthen roof, build it really fast, and be able to have all the benefits. Now, the thing I was looking into ended up not working out. But from reading this book, and I was able to then read a variety of other books and stuff like that, and I kind of came up with a hybrid idea between many of these different books, and this is where I came up with WOFATI. So the key is that fast to build, very inexpensive. I think that the engineering that Mike Ehler had in his book was brilliant, and I'm leveraging a lot of that. In fact, from the WOFATI design, 80% of it is based on Mike Ehler's designs in the $50 and up underground house book. But this is a WOFATI is, by definition, an above-ground structure. And so it's never, ever an underground structure for a home, although we do have some variations where we're going to attempt, we haven't done it yet, but we're going to attempt to make a freezer and a root cellar using a lot of the thermal inertia techniques that are used for the home. But, you know, starting with the home, one of the big things is that you just mentioned is that it doesn't need any heat or air conditioning. And so this is not through anything solar. This is by using the heat that comes in summer to heat the home in the wintertime. So this is thermal inertia. The key to the structure has to do with the above-ground roof design. And as long as you shape your roof in this very particular way and meet this very particular criteria, then the entire structure ends up being freaky cheap.
Which is awesome, right?
Yeah. So
now, there's a couple of things, though, that are kind of required to do this. And the one is actually trees.
True. And so WFATI is a crappy acronym. And and part of it is like when I talk to Mike Ehler about his book, and I talk to him about, you know, okay, underground and how it could be above ground, and he's like, sure, 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 make it above ground. On half the time I talk to him, he's like, no, I shouldn't have called it underground because it gives people the wrong idea. The other half of the time he thinks that he should have called it an earth-integrated house. But setting that aside for a moment, WFATI is a crappy acronym. The W stands for woodland. And so I believe, because a lot of these eco buildings I see getting built, it's like, I'm going to build a straw bale house, right? Cheer, because that's where I bought my land. And so then it's like, well, where is the straw coming from? Well, it turns out that they put it onto a semi-truck 1,500 miles away, and they're shipping it over. And so to me, that kind of, you'd like lose a lot of your eco points right there. And so I prefer the idea of making something that's on your own land, using dominantly materials from your own land. I've been to properties where it's a woodland, where they've got a forest, and they have this beautiful log cabin. And I say, wow, you built this using the trees off your own land? Oh, hell no. Huh, this is a kit that came from Canada.
Right. It's crazy.
And so it's like, all right, well, why did you do a kit log home instead of building your own thing? And it's like, well, because it's a lot of work. And so it's like, well, why is it a lot of work? What would be easier? What can we do to make this a simpler thing? This is kind of where a lot of the WFATI comes in again. And so the idea is that in order to qualify as an eco building, the first ingredient is, because if you build it in a woodland, you can use the wood from the land. And then all the other material that you bring onto the land could fit into a car. And you can build it yourself using material that fit in your car plus the logs that are standing on your property. So the idea of building this someplace where you don't have a woodland doesn't work. I mean, because then you're like, oh, we have to haul in the logs. Maybe someday, 40 years in the future, they'll have kit WFATIs, like they have kit log homes and stuff. But that's going to be outside of my comfort zone. So W is for woodland. O is a tip of the hat to Mike Ehler. And so his last name is spelled with an O, O-E-H-L-E-R, but it's pronounced Ehler. And then the F is for freaky cheap. And then the ATI is for annualized thermal inertia. And I need to have a unique name because, like, the problem that Mike had to do with the fact that because he called it underground, people wouldn't read his book. Same reason why I didn't read his book. If he called it something weird, then people would be open to the idea that it might be something different. And then when you open his book, the first thing he says is that when people think of an underground house, here's what they usually think of. This is what he calls a first thought house. In my article, I refer to that exact same design as a don't do this house. And that's where you've got something where you've got a simple box that might be kind of long and it's on a slope and the glass faces downhill. And there's only glass facing the downhill side. No other glass in the house, only a whole lot of glass facing the downhill side. And so I call it a don't do this house, and Mike calls this a first thought house. And in the article, I try to make a lot of diagrams to explain why this is a terrible idea, but mostly it's because as the water comes down the hillside, then it just hits the house. And now you've got all these problems of, like, what do you do with this excess of water that's building up on the roof and the back end of the house? And so a lot of people have built these, and then they go into all this work to try and mitigate these excessive water problems. And it's kind of like usually what they do is not enough. It always ends up – and they build these things out of cement, which I don't think – because cement always is being packed into your land. I don't know of anybody who's, like, making their own cement on their own land. There's all this stuff about making the house out of cement, and then it's like a basement. It's like, congratulations, your home is this year-round basement, and it smells musty. And there's reasons for the musty smell, too. And it's kind of like, this is all these things bother me, and I don't want to live in a year-round basement. I want a home. I want a house. I want something that's amazing and beautiful. So at the same time, you know, the annualized thermal inertia work, a lot of that is based on John Haidt's work in his book Passive Annual Heat Storage, where you know, it's the same kind of thing. He's storing the heat from the summer to use for the winter, and he has successfully built several homes that require no heat whatsoever. And when we look at all of our energy issues with so much pollution, most of which people aren't even aware of how much pollution there is and how much of a stomach ache there is in pollution with energy, then it's like, this is like one of the most massive things. If you can eliminate your need to heat and cool your home, that's more than 3/4 of household energy use. So here we have a design. And of course, passive solar is something that a lot of people are keen on. And passive solar is like a good 80 to 85% solution. If it's done really, really well, you might even be able to get it up to like 90, 95% solution. But it's also a lot of glass, and it can be extremely expensive. And passive solar is also something which sometimes can get to be too hot. And you start relying on a lot of technological stuff. Whereas this is another thing, people could design homes that merge Wafati-like ideas with passive solar systems and get the best of both worlds. But with a Wafati, we believe that we're going to be able to keep that home perfectly comfortable all year long without having to use any energy whatsoever. And that's another thing too. Passive solar, while it might be able to keep you warm enough in the wintertime, it might also make you way too hot in the summertime. And granted, there's all these things you can do with shading and stuff like that, or you could even design into your passive solar systems an envelope house, things of that design. But I think Wafati is going to end up being a big winner in this space, because Wafati will be able to be built for a fraction of the cost of what it's going to cost for your passive solar systems. All right.
Well, I have a question about the annualized thermal inertia. Is there temperature differences, meaning like, is there an ideal situation where in the summer it gets to be a certain temperature that will help you in the winter? Or, because some regions might not have the larger swings in temperature.
Uh-huh.
Do you know?
Well, so yeah, there's going to be some regions. Like if you're down in San Diego, it's like which you're going to be very familiar with. But if you're left near the ocean in San Diego, I think the coldest it gets in the average year might be like 45, and the hottest might be 85. Is that about right?
You're saying on the average?
In an average year.
Yeah. Oh,
what was the coldest it got in the last 365 days where you're sitting and also like right next to the beach?
All right. This is an unusual year we had. We had severe frosts and things. So it did get down to the 20s in San Marcos right now. And then in Oceanside, I would say it got down to... Oh, certainly the 30s, but the heat can get up to as much as 100.
So now the heat where you're at or at Oceanside?
Could be both. Where I'm at, it'll get a little bit warmer, but certainly it could get that hot in Oceanside as well.
Okay.
It's on these freak days. It's not like long-term.
So here in Montana in the last year, I think we hit, we used to hit 30 below, but in the last few years, I don't think it's gotten below zero. And I think, so maybe this last year it got down to like 2 degrees. So, you know, it's warmer now, but I guess we're not supposed to call that global warming or climate change. I don't understand all of that. But, and then the hottest we had was like, I think last summer, we had a day that it got to 104 for a day. So we've got probably a little bit more temperature swing than you do. I was kind of thinking that, you know, like in San Diego, close to the beach, that your highs would be not as high and lows were not as low.
But on the average, our highs are in the beautiful, you know, high 70s, low 80s in the summer as an average. The high could go as high as 100, and you know, but that's quite rare, but it does happen. And then in the winters, I mean, all year round, we don't have these huge swings on the average. But if you have one or two days of high temperature could heat the thermal mass, you know, sufficiently, you know. But again, we have the problem. We don't have the trees. So Wafati probably wouldn't work here. I mean, if we had the trees, absolutely.
Right.
All right.
So let's talk about my neighborhood.
Yeah, because it makes sense where you are, and let's talk about your neighborhood. You have trees.
True.
Lots of them.
And especially at you know, where I live right now. I've got forests, lots and lots of forests, thick forests. In fact, a lot of the forests are too thick, and last year we had forest fires because it was very droughty here, and the trees caught on fire, and it was all... But all right, so leaving that aside, the important thing to focus on for a moment is the annualized thermal inertia, and so then the idea is that when you examine the underground house theories, then what it is like, okay, in Montana, when you go 20 feet down into the soil, it's a constant 54 degrees all the time. Year after year after year. And it's possible that given temperature fluctuations over the last 10 years, maybe it's now 55 or 56, whereas in the past it had always been 54. Through mysterious, I don't know what you want to call it. But if you examine that, then it's like, okay, if I build an underground house, then I'm going to be leveraging that. So this is what Mike Ehler does in his work, is it's like, if you build an underground house, then you're leveraging that 54 degrees. Now when you build a fire in your home, then you're going to, you only have to raise the temperature from 54 to 70, as opposed to previously, where if you've got a stick-built house, you have to raise the temperature from, say, 32 degrees to 70 degrees.
Right.
So you don't have to as far to go.
Mm-hmm.
So then the purpose, the function that we're trying to do with Wafati is to say, you know, that thermal inertia is a great thing, but what if we could change it from 54 to being 72? And then once we've set that mass to be 72, we've defined what the constant temperature is, then we can just bask in the glow of that temperature all the time. And then, of course, if it's cold outside, like let's say it's 32 degrees outside, so it's at freezing temperature, and inside it's 72, so that's a 40 degree gap, and so we've got windows, and then of course the windows there's heat in the house that's leaking out, and it's like, and of course the windows, they don't radiate heat, they radiate lack of heat. So basically the heat from our bodies is kind of sort of heating the windows. I mean, you start getting into the physics of this, I don't want to really touch into that. But so if we opened up all the windows, the temperature inside the house should drop down to like 40 or something. It'll get a lot colder really fast. But like, okay, let's say we've got our windows closed and it's cold outside, but it's warmer inside because we've got all this thermal inertia. And so gradually our thermal mass is going to move from 72 to maybe 70 or something like that. So because it gave us some of its heat for us to stay warm. And so we've got the heat that it had now on our bodies, and we're staying warmer at 72. And then at the same time, it doesn't stay below, I mean, it might get below freezing and stay below freezing for a week or two, in which case we're kind of using up a lot of our thermal inertia from our thermal store. And now our thermal mass is lowering in temperature. Oh, no, maybe it's 70 degrees instead of 72 in the house, or 69 instead of 72, things like that. But on the other hand, it has like a very large mass, and that heat will redistribute itself, and it will come out, and we'll feel that heat, we'll experience that heat, And then at the same time, when it gets to be now when we get to spring, then maybe our thermal mass has cooled down where it's like, you know, 5 feet into the wall. Instead of being 72, it's now 68 or something like that. Then as we move into summertime, then that's a much cooler source. And if it's like 85 outside or something like that, now it's heating that mass up again. And by the time we enter into fall, maybe that thermal mass is at it's more like at 75. So we're using that same leverage. We're just resetting the average temperature point. But in theory, 20 feet away from us, it's a fixed 72 degrees. As opposed to with a standard underground house where 20 feet away, it's a fixed 54 degrees. But in Mike Ehler's designs, right next to the house, it's always 54 degrees. But with the Wafati design, the idea is that we want to set the point throughout and to 20 feet away to be our fixed point, the temperature that we've elected. And then the way that the heat exchange happens, or that point gets set, has to do with what people find to be the most comfortable. And it's like when the temperature outside is more comfortable than the temperature inside, people will open a window. And that helps to regulate what is the set temperature. And then, of course, throughout the winter, there is a little bit of cooking that goes inside. And so, you know, if suddenly in the middle of winter it starts to get too warm inside because of some cooking, then you open a window.
That's great. And so what about the size of these structures? I guess it doesn't really matter because the Earth's temperature, the mass, is constant. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. If you make it bigger, if you make like a 20-bedroom home,
well, okay. What's your plan on your property for these? You want one structure or several structures?
We plan on building four of these this summer, and we're just getting started on the first one. We've cleared out the trees and the stumps from an area. We're just beginning to shape the land for the Wafati to go in. The first one's going to be a very simple 400-square-foot structure. And I think that a lot of people listening to this are going to be thinking like, you're not going to be allowed to do that because, you know, there's all these building codes and things like that. We're in an area where we're told effectively there are no building codes. And so you can build anything that you want. In fact, we chose this piece of land specifically for that property, for that attribute. Is to be able to come here and build whatever we want to build, because we've got a lot of experimenting to do, and we believe that once we've built the first, you know, half dozen or so, we're going to learn so much that we might modify this design a lot, and we need a lot of room to be able to optimize designs. I like to think that by the end of 5 years, we might have built like 12 of these or so just here. And some will be bigger. But we're going to start off small. I feel like, you know, we've got a lot of experimenting to do.
Sure. And you're 6'6", so you need to have it tall enough for you to enjoy it.
You know, I want to make it so that a person that's 6'7 could even come here and enjoy it, Paul.
Really? Oh, okay.
In case you were thinking of, you know, ever coming to Montana. That's why.
Well, someday. That's great. And the freaky cheap part, I mean, that's the awesome thing of it all, because I mean, people spend so much money on worthless crap, and here we are actually using the resources available on the land. And so talk about the part that you would actually have to spend. So there's obviously man hours that you – or person hours you'd have to put into it, but the actual commercial products you'd have to purchase, what would those be?
Well, I think that there's going to be an impermeable layer, but it's like – I also think that when we look in the historical records about the people that lived here before the Europeans showed up, you know, call them the first peoples, the Native Americans, the Indians, they had some structures like this that they built. And so whereas in our rough designs, there's the current design that's published, which I published a few years ago, talked about layers of newspaper and polyethylene. And the thing is like newspaper is starting to become a little scarce.
Right.
So whereas it's like, oh, we'll just pull this out of the waste stream and use that. And I'm a powerful advocate against the use of newspaper and cardboard in horticultural practices, which are common with most other permaculture people. And I don't like that. And one of the reasons I don't like it is because it can create a water impermeable layer, which can be very problematic for your horticultural endeavors. But it's like, let's do things in such a way where where that's a benefit, where we're going to use it as a benefit. So then in the roof design, there would be newspaper and this polyethylene. But we're currently exploring the idea of using old billboard material that, because it currently just gets thrown away. And it's a very stable material and strong. And so far, our research seems to suggest that it is, not that toxic. I mean, basically, this is kind of, part of what we're thinking of. So we're going to start with this now. And then later, when we get into optimizing our designs, we're going to explore the use of more natural materials, possibly the use of a clay layer. Some of the first peoples would use birch bark, and we'll explore some of that, maybe different kinds of barks and things that we can preserve as we're putting them into the systems, and therefore they will remain waterproof. So
now, when you say billboard, are you talking, like, I know down here that these are the big, huge signs on the freeway, and is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, when
yeah.
I picture where you are, I don't picture billboards.
There are some here.
Okay.
Probably not nearly as many as there are where you are.
Yeah, we would have an abundance, so maybe you give us some trees, we'll give you some billboards.
Huh. Nice.
I know, but we're pretty far from each other, Paul.
This is a waste stream that's around here, and at the time, I mean, there some people are using it. Most of the billboard people are throwing it away, taking it to the dump.
Yeah.
So it would be something we're pulling out of the waste stream, and we'll see if we can put it to use.
Certainly creative, and if you have it as a resource, that's great. Now, I'm looking at the one picture. It's called the roof layers, and it has the blue sky, the wet soil. I'm wondering how heavy all these layers would be on the roof, do you think?
I'm going to go – my answer at this point is very heavy.
Uh-huh.
And so then the systems need to be designed in such a way that they're going to be able to handle that kind of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why inside of the Wafati there tends to be a lot of poles, like every 10 feet, or maybe you can go as far as every 12 feet. And it depends on, the type of wood and the strength of wood that's for the cross sections. But yes, because part of it is that we want a very thick earthen roof. And that's part of the mechanism that we're working with here. For a variety of different reasons, it buys us lots of things. But one of the other things is, and this is kind of a comedy bit that maybe it would be worth pointing out, is that with a thick earthen roof, you can get a lot of things to grow on it, shrubs. I've even seen some ailer structures with a thick earthen roof that had trees growing on it, like cedars. And I've got video of one of the structures with cedar trees growing on the roof. But one of the amazing things is that these structures become invisible. I mean, they're from the inside, there's lots of light and you have this wonderful view, but from the outside, it just looks like a hillside. And so there's this great story where there's this this guy in Europe. He's built a 4-bedroom ailer structure, and the Department of Making You Sad showed up and said, "We hear that there's a structure here and that you built it without a permit, and so, we need to go over all of that and slap your hand for that. And then, of course, we need to raise your taxes because, you've got a building here. We need you to pay taxes on it and things like that. And so this guy was like out in his garden, poking around his garden. He has 2 acres of land. And he said, well, if you can find it, I guess I have to, you know, do all that stuff. I have to pay all that money and whatever. Maybe you can point it out to me. So these three people, I understand it was three people, walked around the land, and they couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And so they left. And no permitty stuff, no having to pay extra taxes, none of that stuff. Of course, you know, that sounds like a lot of risk, and it's technically illegal in Europe, wherever that was in Europe. But it was a 4-bedroom house on 2 acres, and they couldn't find it.
Right.
So I think that's pretty cool. And plus, if we're trying to think about being more eco and green, then, I mean, what could be more eco and green than a house that blends into the environment?
Right. And, you know, I'm looking also now at the picture of Seth's root cellar with the big boulders. If you had access to boulders, that could be another way to support that extra weight on the roof. You know, have a hybrid type thing.
Well, I was there when they made that root cellar, and I got to tell you, that took a lot of time.
Yeah.
And that was some big equipment that was moving those rocks around. So the rocks definitely look pretty, but at the same time, it's a different kind of look, a different kind of thing. There's stuff to it that's different. And while it works good for that particular root cellar / animal shelter,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how good that would be if you're going to make a home. But, of course, in my article, we talk about this kind of general design for not only a home, but also the idea of the root cellar and the freezer and stuff like that.
Well, the freezer caught my eye. I thought that was kind of very clever.
Well, so now we haven't built one yet, and this is a to-be-done, and this is definitely a deviation away from Ehler's work and John Haidt's work and that kind of stuff. But here in Montana, we'll get temperatures below freezing throughout a lot of the winter. And so basically I'm kind of thinking to myself that with this big thermal mass that we have to work with, then what if we routed a bunch of ducting through the thermal mass, like a lot of ducting, and then when it got to be like 10 degrees out, then we open up all the ducting. And so then that will help to set the temperature of that thermal mass. And then when it gets to be 15 degrees, we bottle it all up again. And maybe we'll do that 3 or 4 days out of each winter. Then will we be able to hold that cold through the summer? And so this is very experimental. We'll see.
Well, yeah, maybe if you ran polytubing with water in it, you know, it could freeze the water on the outside, but it would go all the way through. I don't know. I'm not mechanical in any way, but it when I read this, I'm like, wow, that definitely sounds like a very good idea.
Well, dry soil has an enormous amount of thermal inertia and at the same time an enormous amount of insulative value.
Mm-hmm.
And by enormous, I mean like it's something like R2.5, maybe R3 per inch. So it's not too bad. Or maybe it's I'll have to go look at my numbers. But I remember that it's like it's definitely less than like straw bale. And straw bale is like definitely less than most of our modern insulations. But the fact that it's 20 feet thick gives you something. Whereas like straw bale isn't all that insulative per inch, but because the walls turn out to be 18 inches thick, then you get a lot of R value for the entire wall. Same kind of thing as soil. I think soil is far less insulative than straw bale, but it also has this thermal inertia factor as well. And so we're leveraging both of those things.
Yeah. So looking at the Wafati definition, the number one thing you listed, and I think it's very important if you read the whole article, is you say that every drop of rain must always have a complete downhill soil path. Encountering the edge of the roof is not okay.
So that's the magic.
Yeah. Because of the water. Is that correct? The problem with the other design is that the water comes in, you get the musty smells, mold perhaps, and this management of water is critical to the success. Is that what you
right.
would say?
I mean, basically it's like, okay, for your conventional home, you need to have it's the whole thing about when you build a cob home. It's the same thing for a conventional home. You need a good hat and good boots. So you need a good foundation and a good roof. And in this particular case, it's like, okay, so you look at the don't do this design where the windows are facing downhill, and it's kind of like, all right, you need to have a good roof and a good foundation, and all this water is coming, and you need to get it to go away. And you've kind of made it a hell of a job, but you're going to try and fix this through brute force. And so you're putting all this stuff into your designs to manage all this water that's landing on your roof from rain as well as coming down the hillside. And so you've got all these systems upon systems upon systems to try and brute force remove this water from this space. And so when you try to do things in this fashion, then it's like it gets expensive.
Yeah.
And then if you're trying to do a green roof of any kind, I mean, if you compare your traditional green roof to a conventional roof, like three-tab asphalt stuff, then the green roof is generally 10 times more expensive. And it's because there's all of this, you know, the extra weight to deal with, as well as, you know, what to do with the water, how to make sure the water doesn't pool up on the roof, thus making the roof so heavy that, you know, it's ridiculous to try and support it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So with this design, then, you know, there's a limitation. You can't have one of those sun tubes, you know, one of those big lights that come through your roof.
Right.
Can't have that. It doesn't work here because water would go down and encounter that, and that's contrary to the design. And the don't do this house, that's you can't have that because the water comes down and it hits that edge that's at the front of the house, and now you got to do something with it. We can't have that either. And so these systems cost money. In this particular one, then the thing is that the water lands on the roof, and no matter where the water lands, it simply runs naturally downhill until it's downhill. You know, you've integrated into the hill. But now it becomes a challenge because so often people are like, but I want to add a so-and-so here. And the way that they want to add it is like, oh, yes, it stops that water coming down, but I'll mitigate it in some way. And their mitigation sucks. So, you know, the thing to do is we just say no, 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 no. Because that mitigation is expensive and it usually makes the whole structure unsound and not work. So instead what we advocate is these designs, these simple designs, where if you just stick to this, then any drop of water will just go downhill and never encounter a man-made thing. Now, it limits the way to look, but we, you know, and Mike Ehler has a video series, and in the second DVD that he sells from his site, he shows how you can get light to come from any four directions. And when we talk about directions in an Ehler structure, we're talking about uphill, downhill, and then this two sides. Whereas most people, it's like they're used to, like, when we talk about the directions of the house, which way is south? Because they keep thinking of the passive solar stuff, which is fine and dandy, but these are earth integrated. These are always aligned into a hillside. Ehler's got some designs that are for flat. All of my designs are for assuming a hillside, because in the permaculture world, that's the best place to build a house, is on a hillside. Not at the bottom of the hill, not at the top of the hill, on the hillside, and not out at flat stuff.
Now, is he in your area?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
He's about 3 or 4 hours from here.
So that's great. How much annual rainfall do you guys get up there?
Missoula gets about 13 inches of rain a year.
Hmm. So we get about 11 to 12, so it's a similar. I thought you would have a little bit more water up there, which I guess you do. Little can be defined that way.
Yeah.
All right. And it's great because he had, how many years ago, when did he build the first structure?
I think he built the first one in like 1971.
Wow, so that's a lot of years of...
Right, and so then the video, so I've been there not that long ago, like last year, so last year was 2012, so it was over, what I was standing in was over 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still standing, you know, and it's the original $50 house. Still standing, thus a testament to the validity of the engineering. Now, granted, I got video of it, and it's a small, humble space, and I think that, you know, when we talk about characters, Mike Ehler is riddled with character, and he is a dyed-in-the-wool hippie. He loves being a hippie. Being a hippie is his life, and it looks like a place a hippie would live in. But I got to tell you, as an engineer, the engineering on this place is sound, as is evidenced by the fact that 40 years later, it's still standing. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I don't think anybody has lived in it. And it's because, you know, Mike's gotten old, and he's living at the bottom of the hill now because of his knees. And so people haven't been living in it.
Yeah.
But it's still standing, and it looks like it's got another 100 years to go. I don't see any sign anywhere that this structure is going to give up.
So the critters, like termites and whatever eats the lumber, that's not, and the moisture is not affecting the wood.
I did not see any signs of it. Now, with any pole structure, the number one place where these problems can occur is going to be at the soil line. Now, Mike's got another structure that he started work on, but he got like, I don't know, a quarter of the way into it, and then he stopped work, and then it sat up there for many, many years. And the rain and the soil at the soil line mixed all up, and so those rotted at the soil line, which is like if you put out a fence post out in the open weather, that's where the rot problem is at the soil line.
Right.
In fact, like with black locust, farmers used to say that if you made a fence post at a black locust, that it would you stick it in the ground, it will last 40 years, and then you flip it over, and you'll get another 40 years. And so that's because at the soil line is where the most activity is. But with the Wafati designs, we're working very hard to do something very different from what Mike did, in that we're going to keep water away from these posts at all time.
Right, and I imagine that you can't flip around the post when you've got all that thermal mat, or, you know, the earthen roof above you with all that weight. I mean, it's not fixing that problem later could really be a challenge.
True.
I guess you just move to your next spot. You upgrade.
No, you don't have to move. It can't be done. So the most documented Ehler structure is by Glenn Kongeiser. And I was out at Glenn's house. I recorded a podcast with him. And saw what he did. And he had one of the posts in his building. It's like a three-bedroom house or so. It's a pretty spacious, big house. And he had one of his posts. And he's in California, by the way. And so he had one of his posts had gotten rotten down there at the soil line. And so he just put up supports where that was, and then he pulled that particular log out, and then he put a new log in. And so he just made a hole that was kind of a slot, so when the log comes in, it goes into the slot, and then the log goes up to its new home, and then he just packs underneath it until the log goes up to the right level, and then pack, and then he removes out the temporary supports.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's done in traditional, like Joey's barn, he had to replace a support structure, I don't know, with a pole or something, and they jacked it up a little bit and wedged it. But I wouldn't want to be the guy standing under there hoping, you know, that it's going to hold, but, you know, that's why we put the experts in there like you.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a big challenge, and I like the idea that these designs that we're eventually will get to the point where we've optimized them enough that people with a low DIY factor could build their own safely.
Yeah.
And right now, I mean, with Ehler's videos that are out now and his book, I think a lot of people that have a medium DIY factor could build one of these and enjoy it. And I would guess that right now there's probably 100,000 of these already built that are Ehler structures. But Wafati...
100,000?
That would be my guess.
Wow.
I'm just speculating based on number of book sales and the number of people places where I've seen them built and the amount of feedback I've gotten of how many people have seen them around and all you know, these kinds of things. This is purely speculation. It's my guess. But at the same time, Wafati is a design that's a step up from that. So Wafati Home, the key is I want it to – it's above ground. I don't want anybody to call this an underground house.
Right.
This is definitely above ground because I kind of think that that's the kiss of death for these designs is to be underground, especially considering that 90% of underground homes are these first thought house or the don't do this house, which are many of them are abandoned because people just didn't like living in them.
Right.
So, you know, let's not do that. Instead, the Wafati designs are definitely above ground and I think are going to be just generally more comfortable.
Okay, speaking of designs, your followers are definitely going to be saying, hey, Paul, are you going to have blueprint designs? We have your article here, but it's not enough to actually build the structure. Are you going to or can you please provide us someday with a product, you know, the design so we can spread it? But I'm sure you want to build a few. Like you said, you're planning on building 4 and perhaps 12 within the next 5 years. But we don't really want to wait 5 years for your...
So currently there are I've done SketchUp 3 different times to try and outlay what the, you know, a very basic Wafati looks like, a one-room thing about 400 square feet. And just before calling, I found out that there's like probably 2 more SketchUps that have been done. And I know that over the last few days, there's a guy that's been talking to one of my staff, and the two people have been working on another Wafati design in SketchUp. So basically, this is a blueprint. SketchUp is kind of blueprint-esque,
mm-hmm.
And so I really encourage people to use SketchUp. I mean, we've got an architect that is one of our Deep Roots people, and he doesn't use SketchUp. He uses other stuff. And I'm trying to encourage him to learn SketchUp because it's like let's start getting these designs exchanged because SketchUp is free.
Yeah.
And so once enough people start passing these designs back and forth, then you can download a design and you can modify your ideas and put it up and see if people like it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely a lot of interest in this. But yes, of course, we also need to get to the point that we're spending a lot of time building these things. And then, like, let's get 2 or 3 years of use behind us and see how we did. You know, and as much as I feel confident that we're going to, like, be able to have, you know, have it be comfortable in the Wafati all year long, as much as I have a pretty strong certitude of that, it's like I'm open to the idea – maybe in the wintertime on a really cold day, the temperature inside might drop to 60. Maybe it's 10 below outside, and inside it's chilly at 60. But you know what? If that happens, I still count that as a success.
Yes.
You know,
significant.
And it's like we just need to optimize our systems a little bit more. But we're on the right path. So... we need to you know, build this. And so, of course, we're building these now. I've had a lot of people tell me that they were going to build them in the past. I don't know what happened. Maybe I need to go read my own forums.
Right.
But right now, we're up to our eyeballs in Wafati projects. And it's like, I think the day after tomorrow, we're going to be shaping the whole for this first Wafati on this land.
Awesome. So how long do you feel it's going to take for your first structure to, how many man hours or people hours? What's your term for that?
Well, yeah, I think man hours is still a term. I mean, we haven't settled on the one that
per me hours
works with women too yet.
Per me hours, how's
that? So hours. See, part of it is like my brother is going to be running point on this first project, and he is he has a rich history of being a construction foreman.
Oh.
And when he works, he can complete any project in about 1/5 the time of what I think it would take me on my best, most productive day.
Right.
And he's very, very fast. So I part of me kind of thinks maybe I should just stand back and let him do it. But we also have, I think we've got like 15 people coming here on Monday, all of whom are like, you know, wanting to put their shoulder in on this project and make it happen. And they're just excited to be part of the first Wafati. I don't know.
Let's say, yeah, to be determined.
Yeah, I'm thinking that once, because like there's been all these little things, like we needed a Traco, so now we've got a Traco. And then it needs, of course, diesel. And we had some problems with people coming onto our land that weren't invited. And they found the diesel, and they thought, oh, look, diesel. My truck runs on diesel. So they emptied the diesel tank.
Wow.
So then we needed more diesel. And we needed a lock for the diesel tank. So now it's locked. It's like, well, in order to move things around far enough so we can have 20 feet, the reach of the Traco isn't far enough. And so we needed a dump truck. So now we have a dump truck. Then it's like, okay, when we have people here working on this, we need a place for them to poop, and I'm sure as hell not going to get a porta potty up here. And so we've designed what we call the pooper, and it's something that meets my comfort zone, my criteria for that kind of thing. So there's been higher priorities that have to be met first, and so but we think that on Monday we'll probably start serious work on the Wafati. I wouldn't be surprised if the shell was done in a couple of days, like just the shell,
right?
You know, although part of it is that we're currently, and that's it. That's assuming that we've already dropped all the logs and are already right there. Because that's another thing, too, is that, you know, while I've got 225 acres, most of the standing wood is green living wood. And it's like, well, what have the bugs hit? What are the bugs taken out? Let's use that. And so what's the standing dead that we don't want to leave behind for the wildlife? And so we're going around checking on that. We're also looking at girdling some trees so that way they can be the standing dead for the next Wafati project. And, of course, you know, while a lot of people are like, oh, no, you're cutting down trees. Well, what do you think houses are made out of?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it's like we have a lot of conifer trees here, and we want to shift into a permaculture system that features a lot of deciduous trees. So, you know, those trees need to come down for our other projects anyway.
Mm-hmm. What about, do you have plans to have, like, solar power in these or any energy, electricity type?
Yes.
Systems.
Yes. So we've made several podcasts about a lot of alternative energy stuff, mostly about rocket mass heaters. But I've made a lot of those podcasts with Caleb Larson, who is a timber framing guy. And but he probably spends about a third of his life doing timber framing, and the other 2/3 is alternative energy stuff. So he's an alternative energy installer. And he is making for us, which I think it'll be ready today or tomorrow, what we're calling a power cart. And It has a bunch of batteries and solar panels and a generator in it, and it can also be something that we hook up to our electric vehicles that we can take down to base camp and charge up by just plugging it into the wall, or, you know, it'll, you know, get enough from solar.
So it's a portable system?
This is what we have right now. Mm-hmm. So as we move from project to project, we can do this. We have an electric sawmill. And this thing has enough battery power, so we could run the electric sawmill just off batteries for 3.5 hours. And the electric sawmill is 220 volts, 15 amps.
Wow.
So it's about 3,000 watts. So that kind of gives you an idea of how much battery power is there. And then
it's incredible.
Yeah, and our little electric vehicles have been awesome. We've got these amazing electric vehicles that we're cruising around on the land with to get our jobs done. And so then, you know, this particular cart is designed to work with the one that's the beefy one. I'm not sure if our little electric vehicle is going to be able to pull the power cart.
Mm-hmm.
But that's our power source. The great thing is, like, when you run a generator – and, like, we've got a generator that's a 7,000-watt generator, which is enough wattage to be able to easily run the sawmill. The problem is that if it's generating 7,000 watts and you're using 3,000 watts, 4,000 watts are just going to waste. They're not being used.
Right.
So, like, if you decided to run the 7,000-watt generator and charge your cell phone, which uses, you know, like, what, 5 watts? Then nearly entire 7,000 watts is going unused, but you're still burning the same amount of fuel. So basically, the power cart turns any generator into a hybrid generator. And so we can charge the power cart from any generator, and it saves it. It saves all that energy. And we can – so it's like, okay, we turn the generator on, and it's going 7,000 watts, but we're only using a couple of hundred watts for whatever reason. The rest of that's going into the batteries, and
right.
We can use those later.
Great. Now, how much does a system like that cost? If you care to share, you don't have to.
This particular system from Caleb, I guess, I think he probably gave me a super, super sweet deal because, you know, I'm awesome.
Oh, well.
And so I don't want to say, but...
Well, does he have a website maybe we could...
His website is ruggedtraditions.com.
All right.
But here, maybe it's safe to say it was under $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's safe to say that. But at the same time, we're also talking about already doing things that might be in the sub $5,000 range for like homes, and that will be built here. And so then that way people can have a power cart. And then it can be used to power their home, or they can move it to a project somewhere, and we can use it there.
So your land, I've seen pictures of it. With these structures that you're going to build, are you going to have them in close proximity of each other, or will they be spread out in different portions? Or
I think that there will be some of each.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to depend on the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, my. Okay, go on.
So it's going to depend on – some people are going to be wanting to live collectively, more collectively. Some people might even want to live under the same roof. And other people want to be remote. They want to be – but we've got 225 acres. It's going to be easy for people to spread out if they want to.
All right. So you have a long-term plan to have a community built of people that are like-minded and –
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. Paul, we're coming to the end of our hour, and we can continue if you want. We can talk for another hour if you want, but I want to respect your time. But for now, what would you like to do? We can continue, or we'll just say we'll talk to you next time.
I have 6 projects waiting for me,
all right.
All scheduled out for the rest of my day.
Wonderful. Paul, have a great day. Everyone, go to permies.com, richsoil.com, and we'll see you next March at Permaculture Voices conference, which is permaculturevoices.com to learn more about that. Please buy your tickets. And Paul, thank you so much. You're my you're my person I look up to, even though I'm an inch taller than you. All right?
Thanks, Paul, for having me.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks, everyone. Bye.